Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm joined by the author of multiple graphic novels, including My Friend Dahmer, Punk Rock and Trailer Parks, Trashed, and the Eisner Award-winning Kent State, Four Dead in Ohio. His alternative comic, The City, ran in over 75 weekly newspapers for 25 years, and his book, My Friend Dahmer, was adapted into a feature film in 2017. Durf Backdurf, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the Eisner Award for Kent State.
Thanks. That was a big thrill.
Well, this is a doorstop of a book. It's 280 pages.
It is. It's a heavy book.
And the last 25 or 30 of those pages are all research notes. I mean, you really put in the time on this project.
Yeah, I did. Four years total. And the first 2 years were spent just, you know, digging through the archives and doing research.
Well, I've read a number of articles over the years about the May 4th, 1970 massacre at Kent State University. I mean, Kent State is just synonymous with what happened that day. And it's such an absurd and senseless incident. But still, until I read the book all the way through, I didn't know a fraction of the story.
Well, it's good to hear. That means I did my job. It's a surprisingly complicated story because it's really the bloody climax of about 7 or 8 years of civil unrest in this country and all of these forces that were roiling the nation in the 60s all came crashing together, perhaps inexplicably, at Kent State University. So, you know, you have to work in some backstory, you have to work in some context, but I really strove to tell a very tight, suspenseful narrative. And despite being, what did you call it, a doorstop? I think it's a pretty intense read. I mean, it goes fast and it's a page turner. So, because a great story, I mean, it's just a fabulous story.
Well, let's start with a personal angle because that's the way the book begins. Mm-hmm. You grew up in the town of Richfield, Ohio, about 20 miles west of Kent.
Correct.
And you show yourself with your folks reading Mad Magazine. Were you already a comics artist back in grade school or just a comics aficionado?
Oh, yeah, I was drawing. I have some political cartoons I drew at age 10. So I was kind of a prodigy. Then I stalled, of course, when I, you know, at a certain point. But I got off to a fast start. No, I grew up there. So I've always had this connection to the massacre because, you know, I witnessed part of it. I mean, this is not my story. I'm not of that generation. You know, I came of age in 1980, not 1970. And the world had changed by then. And I didn't go to Kent. So, I'm kind of an outsider. But when you grow up in that area, Kent State Massacre, it's part of your DNA. I mean, everybody knows about it. Everybody knows somebody who was there. People are connected to it in unusual ways. So for all those reasons, and because the Guard was in my town, they were sent in just before the incident at Kent State.
Right. It was only a few days earlier.
Right.
And you were, you show yourself in the car with your mom driving past these National Guard troops standing up against striking truckers.
Right. Right. And it's, you know, it's when you're that age, I mean, to have the military invade and occupy your hometown is a little disconcerting. You know what I mean? It kind of felt at that moment that the entire world was just rushing in, you know, with these troops. Because up until that point, it had just been an abstract. You know, these things had happened. There was the Vietnam War going on. But as far as I was concerned, the Vietnam War was always going on. I don't remember a time when it wasn't. And campuses were in flames and streets were, you know, there were street battles everywhere. But again, I don't remember a time when that wasn't the case. But when the soldiers came in and they're literally lining the streets of this little town I lived in, and facing off against, you know, these Teamsters who were my neighbors, they were the parents, you know, the fathers of my schoolmates, it really screwed up my head. So yeah, that's why it really has stuck with me all these years.
Well, we already know the outcome of the story going in. It's right there in the title, Four Dead in Ohio. And the choice you make is not just to bring these four students to life for the reader, but you're trying to bring the whole campus, the whole town to life, the way it was in May of 1970.
That's right. Yeah. And that was not an easy task. I mean, that's why it took so long to research, because, you know, it's a very small window and nothing changes faster than a university and a college town. I mean, it's just constant change. So I had to hit this very tiny window and figure out what was where and what buildings were there and what were not. And, you know, I mean, it took a long time, and then track down the visual reference for those things, which was not easy as well. So it was a lot of detective work, which I kind of enjoy, but it was very challenging. And then on top of it, I had to figure out what happened. And, you know, it's all kind of cloaked in lies and misdirection and misinformation, much as what we're seeing now, say with, you know, the January 6th insurrection. It's just all this misinformation, and, you know, people have different points of view, and there's a bunch of, you know, just outright lies and conspiracy theories. Same thing in 1970. It's really shocking how little we have advanced as a culture in 50 years. I mean, it's just the same stuff repeating.
Yeah. Yeah. With the internet now, you know, you'd think things would be different, but,
It may be worse, but it was pretty bad in 1970 too. You know, that was one of the worst years we've ever had.
Yeah. The warm glow of Woodstock had, turned into the paranoia of Altamont.
Well, Woodstock was an abjuration, really. I mean, I actually think Altamont really represents that era and that year a lot more than Woodstock did. Woodstock was just a happy accident. But I mean, the rest of 1969 in particular and into 1970 was absolute turmoil. I mean, you had political assassinations and just, you know, it was just riots in the streets. And, you know, like the country really seemed like it was teetering, literally on the edge of open civil war, and much worse even than what we just experienced in 2020, because it was so widespread, it just wasn't focused in one place. Now we could well exceed that, you know, moving forward, God knows, but you just can't, it was really hard to try to portray that in a way that people could understand, because I think it's been forgotten by a lot of people. You know, when they think of that era, they think of, oh, Woodstock. Well, no. I mean, a much better representation of that year, of that era, would be the Days of Rage in Chicago, which was a four-day riot. So, you had to work in this context without slowing down the story. I don't know if your listeners, well, I assume they do, know who the Weathermen were. They were the radical, violent radical fringe of SDS, Students for the Democratic Society, which was the largest student anti-war protest group in the country, something like 150,000 members. And somehow, through some perfect storm, they managed to seize power and take over SDS in some kind of bizarre coup in 1969 and ran it into the ground within like 3 months. And it peaked at the Days of Rage, which was in Chicago, which was a planned riot to protest the trial of the Chicago Seven, which, you know, we just saw in the Netflix series. And it was a debacle, and they all had to go underground and then proceeded along in a long kind of terrorist bombing campaign against the forces of the U.S. government and the man. But they're key to what was happening leading up to Kent State, because the paranoia associated with the Weathermen is almost, Al-Qaeda might come close, but I mean, even Antifa does not really reach the paranoia that the Weathermen generated in 1970. And it was totally inflated by the U.S. government, particularly the FBI and the CIA and the intelligence services, by a thousandfold. They said there were 10,000 Weathermen out there underground waiting to strike at any moment, when in fact there were like 40, and you know, they were all in hiding. So we're seeing some repetitions here. You know, again, the weathermen are this kind of, we're inflated to the point that Antifa has been inflated. But except the weathermen were real. I mean, they actually were pulling off strikes. But the Kent State was a weatherman hotbed. It was one of their bases. So that paranoia was really playing a huge role in the lead up to the shootings.
You write about a fellow resident of Richfield, your hometown, Carl Oglesby. He became president of SDS, Students for Democratic Society.
And was purged by the weathermen.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was. He's an interesting cat. I wish I could have, he went to my high school too. I wish I could have interviewed him, but he died in like 2006, 2007, something like that. So he was long gone. He has a good autobiography that's well worth a read. But yeah, he's an interesting dude.
Well, the way you tell this story, I mean, it's nonfiction, of course, but it's weirdly cinematic. The way that all these pieces fall into place one by one in the lead up to May of 1970. You got the town gown conflicts in Kent, the arrest the year before of the SDS leaders on campus, the infiltration of student groups by FBI provocateurs. There's a trigger happy governor sending the National Guard all over the state. And then finally, Nixon escalates the Vietnam War into Cambodia.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, it was all these great forces, you know, leading inexorably to May 4. But the story itself, the way I choose to tell this story, is not this big, you know, sweeping history. What I'm doing is focusing on the four kids who were killed, Allison, Sandy, Jeff, and Bill. And if you'll notice in the book, I tell the story almost entirely through their eyes and through their experiences. And one of them was present at everything that happened that weekend. It was 4 days of escalating tension leading to Monday, May 4. So the reader is actually right there on the ground with them and walking through this scene and this story right next to them. And I think that makes it very personal and emotional, because that's, you know, this is where you find the humanity in the stories with these people. And when they're cut down, it's a gut punch. And so the great sweeping stuff is kind of, it's in the background, and I try to work it in as we move along. But the focus is really on those four.
And, you know, I think to this day, a lot of people think that the four students who were shot dead and the nine others who were injured were all hardcore radical activists.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, that's the furthest thing from the truth. One of the four that was killed was Bill Schroeder, a military trainee. He was ROTC cadet on campus.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. About half the kids who were shot were not protesting at all. The important point here is that the university was still open because the governor refused to close it because that would be quote unquote giving in to the radicals. And there were a couple protests in the days before. There was some window smashing downtown to protest Nixon's invasion of Cambodia. What merchants in Kent had to do with that, I don't know. But these things kind of get out of hand. I think beer was involved. And then the following day, the ROTC building was torched. A group of students did finally set fire to this wooden ROTC building and burned it to the ground. So there was some escalating tension, but the governor refused to close the university. 21,000 students on that campus who were moving about during their day while the National Guard suddenly swept through the middle of them. At one point, inexplicably, turned and opened fire into a parking lot full of students, most of whom had books in their hands, and fired, you know, 67 shots over 13 seconds. Four dead, nine wounded, nine shot and wounded.
I think what's fascinating, okay, one of the things you emphasize is just the escalating tension in those 4 days.
It's like a runaway train. Yeah.
After Nixon announces the troops are going into Cambodia. And then one of the threads that you follow is the members of the Black United Students. Mm-hmm. They're watching these developments unfold. And when they discuss the situation, they say, you know, as important as these protests are, we have to start laying low right now, because if we get out in front, we're going to be the ones who are the targets. Right. And I mean, this is something that's relevant even half a century later.
Sure is. But back then, the previous 3 years, the governor of Ohio had sent in the National Guard into African-American neighborhoods in almost every big city in the state to crush some uprising or protest or another. So these kids, most of whom were from Cleveland, inner city Cleveland, and the Guard had been sent in twice in very bloody crackdowns in that city. These kids, they grew up with this stuff. I mean, they knew what it meant when the Guard came in. They knew that those guns were loaded. They knew people were going to get bayoneted. They knew people could well be shot, because they had already experienced that, where the white kids, who were, of course, the overwhelming majority at Kent, I think the African-American population in 1970 was about 2%. So you're talking about 400 or 500 African-American kids in the university. The rest of the 21,000 were white. Those white kids had no experience whatsoever with the Guard. And they just couldn't comprehend that they would ever be in danger or of being shot. In fact, when the Guard started shooting, very commonly, most of the kids thought they were firing blanks. In fact, some of them yelled out, "Don't worry, they're just blanks," as bullets were bouncing off the pavement around them. So it is really kind of if you want to pick the day, May 4, 1970 is kind of the end of white naivete when it comes to, you know, protesting the government.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today with Derf Backderf. He's the author of My Friend Dahmer and the Eisner Award-winning Kent State, Four Dead in Ohio.
Tin soldiers and Nixon's coming, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming, Four Dead in Ohio, Four Dead in Ohio.
There was also, a big influence on culture, and I know that you've been a punk rock and new wave fan since it was all underground scenes. You mentioned Devo, Jerry Casale, Mark Mothersbaugh, Bob Lewis were all Kent State students at the time.
So was Bob Mothersbaugh, I think. Yeah. One of the Bobs and Jerry were both in the line of fire.
Yeah. Jerry Casale, he was friends with I think both Allison and Jeff who were killed. He was out there right on the scene.
Right. Yeah. There was more too. I mean, Joe Walsh was on that hill, believe it or not.
Wow.
And Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders. She was a freshman that year and heard the gunfire as she was walking to class. So yeah, Kent was this incredible music and arts hotbed. Still is to some degree.
Well, I know this had a huge influence on Devo, you know, the band that formed with Casale and Mothersbaugh and Lewis and others, but they started out with an emphasis on art as confrontation, and their concept of human de-evolution kind of grew out of that.
Yeah, I remember those early shows. Yeah, they were more performance art than music. And then later they discovered that they could actually write really catchy songs and took off from there. But early on, they were really kind of a performance troupe, really underground performance troupe. Got a lot of groans whenever they showed up to perform too. The Kent State student body was not exactly embracing them. There's one great, I wish I'd gone, but I was too young. When the John Waters film, the first one, what was it, Pink Flamingos?
Well, that was his first big feature, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When that premiered in Kent, Devo opened for the screening. Now, how would you like to be at that show? Yeah, I was too young, but.
Let's talk about Terry Norman. He may be the most fascinating character in this story, in the same way that Satan is the most fascinating character in Paradise Lost.
Yeah, he's an interesting cat. He was a radical right-wing student who was a law enforcement major. They had a very large law enforcement school at Kent State. And actually, there were probably more radical right students at Kent State in 1970 than there were radical left. So he was one of them. And he had already run a couple undercover operations for the FBI. He was trying to become an agent and had been on a couple missions for them. And he was working for the FBI on May 4. But he was kind of a bit of a train wreck, very reckless, arrogant, confrontational. Everybody on campus knew he was a narc. So, you know, what kind of undercover agent is that, right? Everybody knows who he is. And he was galloping through the middle of this protest with a guard on one side and a group of about 400, maybe, at which declined in number as the operation went on, of protesters on the other side, just defiantly holding an anti-war protest on the college green because the guard had outlawed it. And they said, oh, well, screw you. We're going to have it anyways. And so Norman is running around in the middle of this. He's armed.
He has a concealed weapon.
He has a pistol on him. And it's just really, to me, it represents the recklessness of the authorities on that day. There were five or six law enforcement entities on campus that day, none of them communicating with each other. The guard itself was just a disaster. I mean, the generals were just boobs. And it's just this cascading torrent of incompetence and bad decisions over and over and over again over the course of not just May 4, but just specifically on May 4, but the previous 2 days as well, that led to this tragedy. It's tragedy by incompetence, really. And Norman really represents that in a lot of ways. But yeah, he's an interesting dude. Still around.
Yeah, he's still alive and people have not forgotten him. If I'm not mistaken, he ended up serving a few years in prison for major fraud.
Yeah, he did. Embezzlement. He tried to flee the country. And I can't remember off the top of my head how many years he served, maybe three. And now he's lived out of the public eye ever since and won't talk to anybody and has never talked to anybody. And the last journalist that tried to interview him was a colleague of mine. Terry came running out the end of the driveway and pulled a gun and stuck it in his face. So I don't think you really want to antagonize the guy because he wants to be left alone. Whatever secrets he has, he's going to keep them, which is fairly common on that side of the conflict. Most of the people who did the shooting, and Norman didn't do any shooting, but most of the people who did the shooting have not talked and probably never will.
Well, that's part of the controversy. And I mean, the whole scene was chaotic and you portray it very carefully in the book, right. But
that's what my art form can do. You know, I mean, I can add visual clarity to something in a way that other forms of storytelling cannot.
So Kent State, Four Dead in Ohio is definitely your most serious work.
Maybe. I mean, My Friend Dahmer wasn't exactly a laugh riot, but okay.
Well, you know, most of your other books have some level of levity and absurdity. Even My Friend Dahmer has wacky moments that break up the darkness.
Yeah, a little bit. Right. Yeah, no, Kent is, it's a tragedy. I mean, there's not a lot of joking in Kent State.
People say that your art style lends itself to wackiness. That was certainly the case with your weekly strip, The City.
Yeah, I drew a lot different back then, though. You know, now it's, I think my work has become more refined and more serious. Because I came to books fairly late. I mean, I've only been doing books for like the last 11 years. Before that, I was doing the comic strip, which is a completely different approach in terms of art, in terms of writing. It couldn't be more different, really. And so when I moved to books, I changed my style dramatically. And I think with each book, I've refined what I'm doing a little bit more. And I think you see that in Kent State, definitely.
Well, you still like these strong blacks and geometric shapes.
I do.
Wondering if you were influenced by some of the scratchboard and woodcut artists of the 20th century, like Jacob Steinhardt and Kechakowitz.
Franz Mosriel. Yeah, no, I love Franz. Yeah, that stuff comes filtered through some of the people that really influenced me heavily, like from Raw Magazine and Weirdo Magazine in the early 80s, and specifically Spain Rodriguez, huge Spain fan. And his stuff is really kind of, it's very punky expressionism, really. And I just kind of springboarded off that into doing whatever I did. And when I came to books, I once again looked to him because he was such a wonderful storyteller and the way he composed narrative. So I was studying what he was doing, and it's only natural that I picked up on that again. But I've always loved a good black. Yeah, I mean, I just can't stay away from the ink.
Well, your comics, especially your early work, it often gets the reputation of being acerbic. But for a lot of people, your most popular short comic was your tribute to Mr. Rogers right after he died. You tell a personal story about when you were living in Pittsburgh and going to art school.
I do. Yeah. And I was late getting to class. The place where we lived was some dorms that were maybe a mile away from the art school downtown. I was late getting to class, and believe it or not, they would mark you down if you were tardy to this art school, which is one of the many reasons I left this art school after only a couple semesters. So I missed the bus and I needed to get there. So I stuck out my thumb, and who pulled over and picked me up but Fred Rogers. And it was one of the most truly surreal moments of my life. And considering that, you know, I grew up with Jeff Dahmer, I mean, my bar for surrealism is fairly high, but that one was really up there. And delightful man, you know, I mean, to get a ride with Mr. Rogers is, it's unique.
Yeah, I mean, he was the real deal. He wasn't like one of those kids show hosts that turns into a gruff character after the cameras are off.
No, he was exactly like he was on TV, which made it even weirder. You know, I mean, we're driving into Pittsburgh and, you know, it's snowing a little bit. He's going, oh, it's snowing today. I like it when it snows, don't you? And I'm just staring at him, you know, with my mouth hanging open. So, yeah. It only, you know, it was a 10-minute drive, but it was an amazing experience.
It really, really changed the tone of the day for you.
Yeah, it did. The whole experience. That was the highlight of my whole time in Pittsburgh, which for the most part was fairly unhappy.
Well, you mentioned Jeffrey Dahmer. So tell us a bit about my friend Dahmer. You not only were a classmate of his, but you and your high school buddies actually formed a Jeffrey Dahmer fan club.
Yeah.
The purpose of which was to disrupt polite society.
Exactly. Well, we were always kind of looking to do that. You know, we were a bunch of band nerds and AP geeks, and we were bored out of our minds and, you know, in this small town and looking to just get through the day. And Dahmer was always peripherally part of our circle because he was kind of the same type. And in high school, his behavior began to get more and more bizarre. He had this whole shtick where he would pretend to have epileptic fits, and he pretended to have cerebral palsy for a while. I know that, and believe me, I know this all sounds appalling, and it was. But, you know, we're 15. I mean, we're 15-year-old boys. We're idiots. And we found this fascinating. And so we pulled him into our group and really encouraged him to act up in inappropriate places like the library or the cafeteria or wherever. And he enjoyed it. I mean, he loved it. And, you know, looking back on it, of course, I mean, 13 years later, the news breaks that he is killed 17 people and did what he did to the, to those victims. And with a snap of a finger, that entire personal history was rewritten and now has this very chilling, dark meaning to all of these, you know, these goofball antics. Suddenly they become, holy crap. You know, that's what he was thinking when we were doing this stuff. So that's really what the book is about, this spiral of this kid into madness, mostly while the adult world looked on and did nothing. And it's a very troubling book that I think really leaves people with a lot to think about.
Yeah, well, in the book and in the movie that was adapted from your book, Dahmer is just steadily, his actions, his attitudes are just getting steadily darker throughout the high school years.
Mm-hmm. Particularly high school, yeah. The last 2 years, really from 10th grade on, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, he got darker, darker, darker. And in 12th grade, I mean, he was just about completely gone. And they just kept pushing him along. You know, they didn't want to be bothered. He was drunk all day long because he was self-medicating, you know, trying to quiet these voices in his head, which were threatening just to swallow him whole. And I remember at the time that we were just amazed that he was getting away with this stuff. You know, how do they not know that he's drunk? You can smell the booze on him a mile away. He used to walk through the halls with a styrofoam coffee cup full of like liquor, just sipping from it, you know, and they just didn't want to be bothered. It was in the context of the time. I mean, it was the 70s. So, you know, it was the stoner 70s. It was none of the just say no stuff had come along yet. I mean, it was a different era that's very hard to comprehend in today's zero tolerance atmosphere that school kids find themselves in. But back then it was completely different. Granted, but still, this was so over the top that, it still makes me mad, honestly. It's like, if just one person, just one adult had said, whoa, wait a minute, this kid is really out of control, maybe that would have made a difference. So that's really what the book's about.
Well, it's so interesting that My Friend Dahmer was the one book of yours that the studios decided to adapt into a feature film. As an author of graphic novels, you've joined the ranks of Jacques Loeb with Snowpiercer, Daniel Clowes with Wilson and Ghost World, Jewel Morrow with Blue is the Warmest Color, among others.
Yeah, I mean, everything's coming out of comics these days. Everything in Hollywood is coming out of comics. It's kind of natural. I mean, you know, comics, what are comics? But storyboards. I mean, it's really easy for film people to envision how something will play out on the screen when it's right there in front of them. And I think my books have some pretty, as you said earlier, some pretty cinematic graphic narratives. So it seems to transition pretty well. I was very pleased with how My Friend Dahmer came out. I mean, there are scenes that are right out of the book, and I think that's amazing. I can't say that it was fun experience because of what it is, but it was a very interesting one. And that movie actually was filmed in my hometown. Those are the real places where that stuff happened. They used Jeff's boyhood home as a setting in the book, which is, as it so happens, is owned by a musician, a friend of mine named Chris Butler, who is Jeff Miller's friend in Kent State.
And you talked to him for the Kent State book.
I did. Yeah, his story was crucial. He was my first big interview, and his story formed really kind of the spine of the early spine of the narrative. So, yeah. I mean, it's all these, you know, we all know each other here. It's a small area. If you're a hipster, you know all the other hipsters, but it's funny how these threads all kind of tie together.
Well, don't tell Art Spiegelman, don't give him that line about comics or storyboards for films, because he hates that concept.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, sorry, Art, but that doesn't bother me. I mean, I don't care. Actually, I have another, Trashed is also progressing. as a film. So I've got the screenplay. It's very good. So we'll see what happens there. And Kent State's being shopped around. So literally all of my books are being kicked around by Hollywood.
Yeah, Trashed is the story of your post-high school life, the true blue-collar job that drove you off to art school.
Right, yeah, no. It's after art school, but it drove me off to Ohio State, but it's after art school. I was a garbage man in my hometown. The book Trashed is actually fiction, but it's based on those experiences, which was life-altering. And it's also a deep look into, again, pulling in all that research I like to do. Because when I went to Ohio State, I actually went to major in journalism. So that's my training. And that's what I bring to comics is kind of this these journalism skills that I use to research stories. It's a deep look at this incredible vast world of garbage, which is out of sight, but is stunning in its sheer numbers. And it's also just a funny story about the disgusting things that this poor crew has to do on a daily basis, all of which is real, all of which, everything I depict on the truck actually happened. So I didn't have to make anything up there. It was all too real. But yeah, I say it all the time. Trash made a man out of me. You know, I was a different guy when I wrapped up that year as a garbage man.
Well, that will be an interesting film if it gets greenlit. Some writers really have issues with the adaptations of their work, but yeah, you seemed pretty happy with the film version of My Friend Dahmer, even though, not only did it depart from the comic in some key ways, but the Durf character came off as more of a jerk in the movie than in the
movie. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I came off. He wrote as kind of an asshole. I was not thrilled with that. But Alex Wolff played me, who's a hot young actor. He did a great job. I mean, I think he captured that kind of smart-ass vibe I had going at the time. He's about as skinny as I was. And he's a lot better looking than I was. But, you know, these things happen.
And Disney Channel star Ross Lynch was the teenaged Jeffrey Dahmer. And he absolutely
was great.
He nailed great. That dead-eyed look.
Oh, he did. Yeah, he really did. A lot of my friends were on the set. They spent a lot more time on the sets than I did.
Really? Yeah. So you're friends from school?
Yeah.
Wow.
Members of the Dahmer fan club. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. And they were really taken. I mean, there were times when, I mean, my favorite memory of Ross was that one day I went to the house and they were shooting there that day. And I just walked around to the side and there's this porch that overlooks the woods there. And Ross was sitting there with one of the producers talking. So I went up and said hi. And he was in his full getup, his Dahmer getup. And we were talking and it just suddenly just hit me. And I just said, dude, you got to take those glasses off. You are really freaking me out. Because in that house, to have him look exactly like Jeff, it was just too much. It really just kind of hit me in a wave. And he laughed and took him off. He really liked that. He likes to tell that story himself. But no, he really knocked it out of the park. The performances across the board are really good in that film. I was very pleased with it.
Yeah, like you said, it was incredible how they really went for that verisimilitude. That's pretty rare.
No, I mean, everything was filmed right there in my hometown, except the high school. Not surprisingly, my high school would not let them film inside the school. They asked. They actually had the chutzpah to ask to go before the school board and ask permission, but they said no. So they had to find another area high school that would take their money, and they did. But everything else was filmed pretty much right there in town. It was... I thought the townsfolk would be really pissed at me, you know, because they don't like to be reminded of all this Dahmer stuff, obviously. But it was surprisingly the opposite. They were so thrilled to have a movie being shot in their hometown that, I mean, they had Facebook groups going to, you know, point where the shoots were that day and people stopping by all the time. It was really kind of a big, big event.
People get starstruck.
I guess. But I didn't even do it. I didn't do a cameo in the film or anything. I didn't. All my friends did. They're all in the film. And I was like, nah, that's
oh, not really? Just as extras?
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, yeah, that's, I don't think it's appropriate. I'll pass. So, I mean, you do have to be respectful of, you know, what the end of this story is, because it's not made up. I mean, the end is there are 17 bodies at the end of that and thousands of people that mourn those 17 victims. So, yeah, you just can't be flip with it. And I don't think I ever have been.
Well, you've got a couple of newish projects, which seem to be semi-fictionalized versions of your post-high school life in Akron and Cleveland. Punk Rock and Trailer Parks is one. It's followed up by The Baron of Prospect Avenue.
Yeah, well, Punk Rock and Trailer Parks was actually my first graphic novel. That came out in late 2009, I believe. And that was the book that really put me on the map as far as graphic novels go. Came up by Slave Labor Graphics, which is no longer with us. And that was just a lot of fun. You know, I just needed to get that under my belt and figure out what I was doing. And it's actually kind of this raucous comedy about set in the punk rock scene of Akron, Ohio, with Devo and all the rest of those guys, as we were talking about earlier. And for some reason, Akron, for reasons nobody really ever understood, was this real hotbed of punk rock in the late 70s. And that was a lot of fun to do. And I came up with these really great characters. It's all fiction. And so I came back to it with a web comic, which is called The Baron of Prospect Avenue, which I don't know if I'll ever do anything with it. I'm kind of reworking it to see if I can come up with an actual book that I can do. I'm doing short stories now. I'm doing a bunch of short stories just to, you know, get that mind working and get the creation going.
Is the Baron an amalgam of people that you've known?
He is completely fictional. I don't know where he came from. He just dropped from the sky and just kind of landed in front of me. And you know, as all great characters do, and I'm very grateful. I wanted to do a character-driven book because my comic strip was not. That was freeform. It didn't really have many characters. So it just all came out of jokes and whatever was processing in my head, riffing on pop culture or whatever.
That's the city. That was sort of a mix of absurdism and true stories that people sent you.
Right. Well, most of those were, the true stories were mostly observed by me. But yeah, I did have some friends who supplied me. I didn't take like just unsolicited donations because you never can trust anybody. But I had a few friends who fed me stuff who like worked at public libraries and things like that. And it was just kind of this snarky humor that was very fitting for the 90s. It played a lot less effectively in the 2000s after 9/11, especially. It was just such a miserable decade, you know, that kind of humor really didn't go anymore. And I kept doing it through the 2000s and had a lot of success with it. I mean, I was making money, winning awards and stuff, but I should have shut it down. I should have shut it down and moved on to books. I really regret that.
Well, and alt weeklies, the weekly papers were getting less about deep journalism and more about being lifestyle rags.
Yeah, they're dead. Yeah, they're in worse shape than the daily papers, which is saying something. Yeah, no, they were great when they lasted. You know, I mean, everything has its time. I mean, that's how I look at that all now. You can't expect things to last forever. And the weeklies were fabulous in the 90s and in the 80s as well. They started popping up maybe mid 80s and then through to the end of the 90s. And then the internet came along and basically stole their content. I mean, everything that was in the all weeklies, the personals, the classifieds, the sex ads, music, culture, you know, all that stuff that immediately went to the internet. And that was it for the weeklies. So it's too bad. I miss them. I think they were great, most of them, but, you know, they're done.
I remember this story that Linda Barry told. I think it was actually towards the end of the 70s that she was first doing her strip and living in Seattle. And she said just the check she would get once a month from the Chicago Reader paid virtually all of her rent.
Chicago Reader paid pretty well. But it was pretty, that's still pretty low rent. I mean, if she did. The great thing about doing a strip like that is, I mean, I peaked in like 75 papers. That's as many papers as I was in at one time. And normally I was between like 50 and 75. So, I mean, you draw a strip once and you get paid 50 times for it. And, you know, it's not a bad living. I mean, it added up really, really fast. And as a weekly strip, so you're only doing one a week, it was a good deal. You know, you had a lot of free time, a lot of time to do other stuff and, you know, freelance work or do things like, you know, try to make a book or whatever. It was hard to break into. I mean, I think that was a pretty high bar. That genre, that weekly strip genre, it's like a who's who of Hall of Famers right now. Alison Bechdel, Chris Ware, Ben Catcher, Linda, Matt Groening, of course. Who else? Charles Burns. I mean, all these people were doing weekly strips. It was not an easy way to elbow your way into the genre, but somehow I pulled it off. I still don't quite know how. But anyways, back to punk rock and trailer parks. When I approached that, I thought I want to do a character-driven piece because I had this fantasy that if you come up with really strong characters, the story will kind of write itself. You know, you just plop a character into a scene and the scene will write itself. And damned if that's not exactly what happened. So I really enjoy that way of writing. So, I don't want to let go of that character. I've got another great character from Trashed, whose name is McGee, who's kind of this psychotic young character. And I'm thinking about doing something with him too, because you just can't let these great characters go.
And Hollywood keeps knocking on your door.
Hollywood keeps knocking on my door. Yeah. Well, you can't count on that, but it's been interesting. It's been quite a ride, you know. It's experiences that I never dreamt would happen to me, and they've all just kind of cascaded one after another since I started doing books. So it's been a great 10 years until the plague hit and everything kind of crashed down on all of us. But hopefully we'll get back to a normal world again, quote unquote normal world.
Well, it's been great talking to you. I've been actually wanting to have you on the show for a long time, so this has been a real thrill.
Nice to be here. I really appreciate it. I've actually never been to the Pacific Northwest, believe it or not. I was scheduled to go during the book tour, but that all kind of went south. So.
Yeah, I know. So the whole 50th anniversary of Kent State was right in the middle of the COVID shutdown. So everything got pushed back a year.
It just got pushed into the dustbin, really. Yeah, it was going to be this huge event. It was like covering a whole week. It had all these things happening, you know, on campus. And there were probably going to be 15,000-20,000 people coming in for the event. And everybody was really looking forward to it. And it just got wiped out. I mean, just in the space of like a week. And I felt so bad for the students of 1970 because they had waited so long, you know, for some confirmation, just some word from the university that, okay, you guys exist. And this thing happened and we are embracing this history, because for decades, the university just tried to erase it to the point of like building things on top of the site because they just wanted to cover it up. And now the shooting site is, that whole site is a national historical site, but that was not the case 20 years ago, say. But for the 50th, this was finally going to be their moment, and it was taken away from them. And I just feel terrible for them because, you know, it's not, I mean, not to be morbid, but these guys are all in their 70s now. And we've lost a lot of them, and we just, since the 50th, we've lost a few more, including some of the shooting victims. You know, not many of them are going to be around for the 60th, you know, and they love those nice round numbers. So that's just something that was lost and probably won't be repeated. It's just so bad. It's just too bad.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. And we've been talking today with Durf Beckdurf. He's the author of My Friend Dahmer, Punk Rock and Trailer Parks, trashed, and the Eisner Award-winning Kent State, Four Dead in Ohio. Durf, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
Well, the website is derfcity.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And, you know, you can buy books in the places that you normally buy books. Support your indie bookstore, please.
So derfcity.com.
Correct.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.